Righto, Marty Miners, welcome back to another week. Jeez, we just slot straight into it, mate. Bloody love it. Hey, if yous aren't on the director's special yet, get on it, moneyofmine.com. This bloody newsletter is the only mining email you need to open every day. Can I say it more simply?
I'm really happy with how it's going, mate.
Oh, thanks to you too. Great job. Right, boys, we've got a bit of a day today. A bit of speculation and whatever out of Gold Road.
Yes, mate. Can right. The mighty Gold Road, who has one non-controlling joint venture interest, make it two in Canada?
And a shareholding in De Grey. Predictive Discovery chucked out their study today for the Bandcan project.
You've gone in the weeds here, Matty. You're just Mr.
Mining and now metallurgy.
Hey, you've got a new...
Thanks to Mr. Nathan Stoitis.
What an episode that was.
Fuck, that was a ripper.
I re-listened to it 3 times, not going to lie.
Yeah. Bloody brilliant. Jesus. I'm overwhelmed by the awesomeness.
Keep it going, Matty.
JD, you're... This is reeks of you, Russian metal band from the LME.
I knew you would say that as soon as you read that off. It does reek of me. I'm pretty keen to talk about it. The aluminium price jumped up almost 10% on the LME and nickel up 9%. So very interesting stuff.
Oh, mate, tell you what else is interesting. Rio Tinto's rehab blowout. Mate, Zhao Jin, they've chucked a best and final in for Tieto, giving it a bit of that one. And
that's not the only best and final, mate, because Emerald have done the same at Bullseye.
Is there a best and final coming for Sierra Rutile? Who knows? A little bit out of them. Touching on Emerald, mate, she's absolutely all go. Trav, take it away, mate, because Gold Road has confirmed, based on your long-lost sister's news article in The Australian this morning, confirming interest in a gold project in Australia's favourite gold mining jurisdiction, Canada, where there's North America, where there's been so much success.
There's a lot of angles to this story, and that is one of them, Matty. But the gist of it is, before, you know, I've done some analysis today. I feel proud of myself. I've actually done some work. But, you know, Bridget Carter's done the most work because she's put a banger, a zinger in Data Room once more that's got our attention. So late last night, she revealed in a column that Gold Road is pretty advanced in its attempt to buy a 40% stake in Greenstone Gold Mines off of private equity group Orion. Now, Greenstone Gold Mines is a Canadian asset. It's 40% owned by Orion Mine Finance. That's a private equity group. The other 60% is owned by Equinox Gold. Now, Orion has been looking to sell its stake for some time, and being a private equity group, like, you can basically assume that they want cash. They're going to get a return that, like, it's all to do with the fund timeline, give the cash back to LPs, happy days. And, you know, so in this sort of deal, you've got to think, okay, consideration's got to be cash. And this morning, Gold Road basically confirmed their interest in the asset in this one-page announcement released to ASX in a response to the media speculation. But they say that, you know, there's no binding or definitive acquisition agreements just yet. First of all, before I do a bit of analysis, Matty, what do we know about this asset? Well, we know that Equinox is the majority joint venture partner, and it is the operator of the asset. And that company, Equinox, they gave a big spiel at the Europe Gold Forum last week with a good chunk of detail about where the asset is at the moment. So they say Greenstone is going to be coming online in the second half of this year. It's got an initial 14-year mine life via an open pit, 1.3 grams per ton. They say they expect Greenstone to be producing at sub $1,000 per ounce. I assume that's US. Now, they say it's started hot commissioning already, ramp up in Q3. They reckon it'll get to about 80% full production, and they expect 95% capacity through the plant by the end of the year.
About, what is it, 400,000 ounces, isn't it?
Yeah, in the early years. I mean, it's a pretty
big,
like,
humdinger.
Big humdinger. It is quite large. You're 100% right. And look, Equinox is a US, like, $2 billion market cap company, and their share price has rallied about 50% in about 6 weeks, which is big, like, you know, rally for a company of that size when you factor in the base effect. And, you know, in that time, their valuation discount to NAV has tightened from about 0.64 times NAV to 0.88 times NAV. So my interpretation of that is that, you know, the market's basically saying, we think the Greenstone ramp up is on track and de-risking, you know, your valuation accordingly. Of course, gold prices rallied in the interim as well, but, you know, even that discount to NAV is really tightened. So here's a snippet I just wanted to include of how Equinox talks about this asset in that latest presentation.
It's the It's a rare asset in that it's going to be a very high volume, as you just saw, producer annually. Typically, these mines are owned by majors or very large private groups. So it's one of the very few, as we move forward, high-output gold production mines that's going to be owned by a mid-tier gold producer.
Now, with all of that out of the way, the bigger question to answer is, should Gold Road actually do this deal, right? And I have a bit to say about this topic.
A lot of moving parts here, Trav.
Lots.
To answer this question.
Lots, mate, lots. And the stock's down 8% today, which is more than other goldies are by a long shot. And that's probably got something...
Most of the goldies are down, but not by that much.
Totally, mate. It's probably got something to do with this key sentence in the data room column. It's the third sentence, and it says this. It is believed that should Australian-listed Gold Road buy Greenstone, it would be accompanied by a monster capital raising.
It is believed by who?
A monster capital raising. So, look, of course the stock sells off in early trades today, way to spook the market, and it's that sentence that tells you everything you need to know about the source of this leak. Whoever has leaked this deal wants the deal dead. That's my interpretation, because you leak the deal, allude to an equity raise, the stock sells off, shareholders, you know, they'll eventually speak up against the deal, and the deal falls apart. That's kind of the pathway to kill a deal, right? So perhaps now we should all talk about who has the biggest incentive to kill the deal here?
Well, firstly, it sounds like they've used whoever the source's exact wording is, monster equity raising. sounds like it's come straight from the horse's mouth.
that's probably on the money, right? So I got two theories on who would leak this deal, right? Number one would be, and I've seen this before, it's whoever's got the second second best bid. So like you could imagine, I don't know what stage this sale process is at, but if the sellers or the advisors have declared Gold Road is preferred bidder, typically whoever's like second can kind of figure that out. They can deduce it, and via their advisors, they'll sometimes be a bit cheeky and leak something like this, which can have the effect of killing the deal. And then all of a sudden, the second best bidder is the best bidder.
And we alluded to this exact sort of scenario playing out a couple of years ago in the director special this morning with IGO on the CSA mine.
Yeah, I mean you can follow the article. As they unraveled with that sale process of CSA from Glencore, you know, IGO was in pole position, preferred bidder, deal gets leaked. Of course, there was going to be an equity component to that deal. It was like $1 billion sort of sale price or purchase price. And I think IGO fell about 15% in a single day, which effectively kind of killed the deal for them. And then ultimately the deal was done to Metals Acquisition Corp instead.
You got all IGAs on your mind at the IGA, moment.
My bad.
So here's another left field one. Would the source that leaked the deal potentially want Gold Road to be cheaper because they want to buy Gold Road? More than not as likely.
That's another theory to throw in the mix. And I think the corporate appeal of Gold Road is a big topic I want to talk about towards the tail end of my spiel here, Matty. So back to that better question, right? Should Gold Road do this deal? And subject to whatever the terms of the deal would be, I'm pretty damn critical of this one. I looked at a couple of broker reports for Equinox Gold. These reports, they typically ascribe about US $1.8 billion of NAV to Equinox's 60% interest in the project. So based on that, a pro-rated 40% interest would be about US $1.2 billion. Maybe subtract a little bit for the fact that Orion's share is non-controlling and apply a further discount given, you know, there's still ramp-up risk here, so it shouldn't transact to 1x NAV until ramp-up risk is removed. So call it about a US $900 million price tag for 40% of Greenstone here, or about $1.4 billion Australian. That's just a thumbsuck number based on, you know, those broker reports. If that is the case, I think the data room commentary is right there. It would be a monster capital raising on the cards. Gold Road is capped at only 1.8 billion Aussie itself. So you'd be looking at a hefty entitlements offer to buy this thing. And to get that away, you needed to raise it at an attractive enough discount to the last share price. So I remember when Regis did its 1-for-3 entitlements issue to buy 30% of Tropicana, that was done at a 15% discount to its last traded price. And look, it's actually the equity raise implications of this potential deal that I'm most critical of here.
So if you, none of us are Gold Road shareholders, but if you were, what would you think?
Mate, if I was a Gold Road shareholder, you know, And Gold Road basically decided to buy the Greenstone interest by doing an equity raise at, you know, a 10% plus, 15% discount. I'd be pretty fuming, and I'll do my best to try and articulate this. A company should not willy-nilly dilute its shareholders to do a deal if their scrip is undervalued, because then you're effectively double punishing existing shareholders. Take, for example, look at this chart here. I've simply charted the relative share price performance of Gold Road and its peers on the same chart over the last 12 months to Friday, so to the last price before today. Think Gold Road, Northern Star, Regis, Westgold, Silver Lake, Red, Genesis, Evolution, Ramelius, Bellevue, Capricorn. They're the peers, right? They're all the, you know, mid-tier gold producers with Australian dominant portfolios. And guess which company is the biggest underperformer of the lot? It might surprise you. It's Gold Road.
Yeah.
Wild, right?
Closely followed by Regis.
So, like, this data is before the sell-off today. Last 12 months, right, the share price has dropped 6.8% while gold has been rallying hard. So if the stock has substantially underperformed its peers, why does someone choose to buy Gold Road today? Why would you buy the stock Gold Road today if it's substantially underperformed its peers? I'll tell you why. You buy it because the company is an M&A target and you want it to get taken over. And fair enough, like, what even is this company, right? It's like the worst royalty company in the world. You've got to pay costs. It's like they've got a non-controlling 50% interest in Gruyere. They've got a 20% stake into Grey worth about $480 million. And for the longest time, shareholders have copped having to stump up all of the costs and overheads associated with this company, despite the fact that they aren't a real miner. And look what they spend on exploration every year. Just like, look at that expense, right? So that's some $35 million a year. Unfortunately, they haven't found another Gruyere with that money to date. Throw in another $20 million per annum in overheads, corporate, G&A expense. If you NPV that, call it $55 million a year in overheads to present day terms over a 15-year period, you can kind of paint the case that there's $500 million of present day synergies to any acquirer by simply buying Gold Road, wiping the exploration and corporate expenses, right? Just cut out all of the fat. And you don't actually have to do any additional work if you buy Gold Road. You know what I mean? Like it's not like you have to allocate any additional like overheads yourself to administer these assets. They're non-controlling. It's like sweet fuck all. So
that's an application of where $500 million present day value, like the Karora Westgold thing, is quite applicable, I think.
Yeah, but yeah, you know what I mean? Like, what do you actually have to do owning Gold Road? Like, there's not much work to do.
it's kind of fascinating that they'd look at another non-controlling JV interest as well, given like having tuned into the last few quarterly calls, you know, they've got so much anger at being in that position and pointing the finger and, you know, at various people, mainly the contractor, and saying they can't do much about the situation, that they just look to dig themselves into the same hole again.
Well, I think it's because they don't have operating capability in their team, right? Like why take risk that's outside your wheelhouse? You kind of like, you know, that we all know they had a big crack at trying to get their hands on the non-controlling interest in Tropicana, which ultimately went to Regis instead. Here they are again. It's in their wheelhouse to want to own something where they don't actually have to apply the operating capability. But that to me, like it's just like they're such a potential target to the right sort of buyer, especially given what's happened to their scrip over the last year compared to peers. So
when you look at that G&A, Trav, it's interesting when you think that they are a non-controlling interest in that operation. So technically you would need less people.
Totally.
If you're non-controlling.
Mate, you don't need anyone.
You know what
like,
I mean?
Like the expenses come under the joint venture. That's the G&A outside the joint venture.
Oh, well.
You know what I mean? Like you don't need to spend anything. Cut it all out. Like, yeah. So that's the appeal of like, you know, to a potential acquirer of Gold Road. Now, I'll tell you what you absolutely don't want Gold Road to do. You do not want them to use their scrip when it has underperformed like crazy to get a deal done that is in a different jurisdiction. They'd have to raise the equity at a discount. The deal gets them another non-controlling joint venture asset ripe for Gold Road, who must love not having to do much work. But I'd be pretty filthy if I was a Gold Road shareholder, subject to whatever the terms of the deal are, because we don't really know them yet. But, you know, the financing might be funky. But like if it is a big equity raise and all the rest, I'd be pretty filthy because
so they can't. As you said, Orion want cash, so that it won't be a scrip offering likely to Orion. It's going to have to be some sort of debt equity package to pay for this.
I would assume so. Yeah. And look, you should need to demonstrate to your shareholders that, you know, why you're currently trading at a giant premium to your intrinsic value if you want to use equity, and that's why it's appropriate to use your scrip in a deal. You shouldn't use beaten up scrip to do a deal in a different jurisdiction just because it will fend off potential acquirers who might be circling you, and everyone gets to keep their job. I mean, I want to be fair to this company because I'm at risk of being pretty harsh on them. Like, there are some things I like about Gold Road. For example, they report their corporate all-in cost, or CAKE, as popularized by Johnny Mac, is a fair way to assess their real costs. I just think the company needs to be incredibly thoughtful about articulating why the best thing for shareholders would be raising equity at a substantial discount to get a deal done in a jurisdiction versus just selling themselves at a premium to someone who might be corporately interested in them because they could get, you know, $500 million of synergies on day one.
Based on that, G&A, Trav, soft issues, sunshine.
That's probably right, Matty.
Oh, it was interesting looking at the article from The Australian last year, because they were talking about this Greenstone project and how the most likely, when it was sort of up for sale then as well, the most likely acquirers, they were pointing to Northern Star and Evolution, but then the next paragraph just went on to Ramelius. Seems to be a bit of a relationship going on there.
Matty.
The whole thing was, become you. I love it. Feed well trained.
I couldn't be like you because only you could give the rundown on Predictive's Bankan PFS in the way that you have today, and I'm excited for it.
Back at Bankan. Mate, we're heading over to Guinea, JD, your holiday destination. The Predictive Discoveries PFS is out. Mate, give us the lay of the land before we get in the weeds of this beautiful study that anyone can read to go to sleep. It's just how good are studies. I love them.
Alrighty, mate. We'll stay very much in our lanes, and I'll let you get into the mining stuff. But we'll just skim over the highlights to give people a feel. And Trav, you mentioned Gold Road down 8-odd%. Predictive is as well. So the reception hasn't been too kind to the study today. Although that is a kind of common phenomenon when you get into these studies starting to come out. So they're trading at an EV of about $450 million as we speak. And yeah, the market's not taken a liking to it. So the headline numbers are, they've come out with their maiden ore reserve, 3.05 million ounces, and then they've provided two cases. They're actually pretty similar. One of them's got a bit of an expansion that includes some inferred ounces, so we'll focus on the base case. 5.5 million tonnes per annum processing rate, 11-year mine life. The expansion just has a 12-year mine life. You got open pit and then getting into an underground, averaging 1.4 grams per tonne and then 3.2 grams per tonne underground. 256,000 ounces per annum. It's pretty chunky at 92% recoveries. And here's the cost. All in sustaining cost, US $1,130. NPV 5, using the lower case of US $1,800 gold, is US$570 million. So that's a 24% IRR. And then in the sort of, you know, more bright light scenario, NPV 5 using gold of 2,300. So that's a very recent gold price.
The old 5% discount. US
5% discount in Guinea. I don't know about that one.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Anyway.
So you get 1.2 billion NPV for the upside case and a 41% IRR. And both scenarios show a pre-production capex of US $460 million. So
interesting.
With that discount rate aside, Matty, well, let's get into the mining side of things.
And the metallurgy, JD, because geez, aren't we more much the wiser, the money miners, after Nathan Stoyt has graced us with his presence, mate. Well, most of it's coming out of the open pit. So out of that 3 million ounces, 2.3 million are coming from a 1.4 gram pit. So that's a pretty bloody decent pit. 700,000 ounces coming from the underground. So strip ratio 4.6. Pretty good. Strip ratio is really good at the start. And looking at the underground, that looks pretty bloody good, I reckon. So it's like a bulk mining, so 15, 20 metre wide stopes, 30 metre level spacing. So the you'll read in there, it says that it's transverse primary secondary with paste fill. So I'll show on the screen, they'll be developing into the ore body from the footwall side and then, you know, taking the primary stopes and then this paste fill them and take the ones in between the paste once you're done. So it's one of those ones, once you open those big stopes up, nice and wide, pretty tall, pretty easy tons compared to narrow vein mining at a grade of 3.2 grams per ton. So, look, 15 strike, 20 wide, 30 high. That's 25,000 ton stopes at 3 grams gold. That's bloody, you'd take them any day of the week. So, and I think it looks like they've only got to get it in the first 5 years, they've only got to get 900,000 ton of ore out from the underground. So, mix that with the development ore, should bloody piss it in. So, now they've applied, found this interesting at the start. Mining dilution of 15% and a recovery of 90%. So when you've got bulk mining, especially when you're taking your primaries out, if you're getting dilution from your walls, that's the stopes next door. So it's not waste, whereas it's only the front and back of the stopes dilution and recovery of 90%. It's like if you're paste filling everything, you should be getting most of the ore body. But looking here, they've actually leaving some sill pillars and stuff, so they won't get full recovery of the ore body. So for instance, Bellevue leaving pillars gets 83%. So that means 17% are left in pillars and dirt they don't recover. So 15% dilution, I'm like, oh, that's pretty, looks pretty overestimated for what they're doing. But you look at the dip of the ore body, it's pretty bloody laid over. So if they're coming in from the footwall, they'll have to cut a bit of the footwall out to, because it's sort of going back over themselves, and then you've got the hanging wall coming over at a pretty bloody flat angle, so they might get some dilution off that. So
what's the worst angle to in case that, like, that dilution is like
30, oh, any, anything 40? Like anything 40 or below,
yeah,
it means it's really laying over and you're gonna leave probably even 50 or below, leaving shit on your footwall because it won't rill.
And that's like where that, that's where that, that dilution comes into play.
Yeah, well, the dilution comes from the hanging wall leaning over so much and breaking, just because of the gravity, like it's just laying over. And then your recovery is when it's, you can't get it to rill off the flat footwall and the dirt gets left there, so you're not recovering the ore. So where are we up to?
Metallurgy, mate.
Let me just bloody scroll down. Beautiful pit, beautiful bloody pictures here. But yeah, she's bloody pissing it in. Look at 250,000 ounces, up to 350 by year seven. She's friggin' flying. Mate, metallurgy looks pretty basic for this region by the sounds. Free milling, around 92% recovery. About 39% of that is recovered in the gravity circuit, so that's always good. 5.5 million tonne per annum going through a SABC circuit. So that's a sag, ball, cone crusher, grinding to 75 micron. And as Stoitz said, 75 is about as low as you want to go before you have to go down the ultra fine grinding pain in the ass route.
You're pushing it beyond that.
Yeah, and it's just bloody shitloads of power and everything. So the way, what an SABC circuit is, so it means the sag mill does the, so it goes through a jaw crusher first. Then the sag mill does the secondary crushing, and from that you have these, remember we talked about the scats that come out, you have these parts, the like these oversized parts that the sag mill can't crush. Those scats then come out and go into a cone crusher or a pebble crusher, they call it, and that gets the scats back below that critical size, and then they feed them back into the sag mill, and then all of that then goes into – keeps feeding the ball mill, which grinds it to 75 micron. Biggest, so met looks pretty bloody simple and good. So no met risks here, I don't think. Permitting risk is the big one here, and this is obvious when you see the proposed dry stacked tailings. So when we see in Australia or whatever, when you see like a tailings dam or it's just wet tailings pumped out, thickened up tailings pumped out to the bloody tailings dam, thrown in a big friggin' dam. Dry stack tailings, so you see on the flow sheet, there's a tailings thickener and a detox, which you'd probably, you'd have the tailings thickener So that's what thickens the tailings to pump out to a wet tailings dam anyway. Detox probably, depending on if you needed it for approvals for the cyanide management. So I don't think every operation has a detox, but detox is usually an option that like neutralizes the cyanide in the tailings. But then you see there's a filter press to give a dry tailing. So, and once it goes through the filter press, you have this dry tailing stack, which should be no cyanide in it. You've then got to truck that load and truck that dry stack tailings to the dry stack tailings facility, which is pretty much like a tailings waste dump. So some of that gets used for the paste backfill. So I guess between the filters and the loading and trucking, it's a bit of extra OPEX to manage the tailings. But the only reason they would be doing that is because they have to try and get it permitted, because they can't have a wet tailings dam effectively. So
they're in the sort of secondary buffer zone, that's what it's called.
I'll go through it down here. It just shows where they are, and they're sort of on the fringe a bit. Also, they're looking to get a better power solution. So currently they're going down the route of diesel generators with solar farm. But there's this Linsen foamy transmission line. Wouldn't have pronounced that right. Sorry, don't care. That'll give them grid power. So it sounds like Guinea is trying to strive to get grid power to these operations. Not yet. So that'll be a big one if they can get that over the line and actually get main supply rather than going down the other route. But with diesel generators and a solar farm, first call they should be making is Silverstone. That's the logical thing, even at this early stage. They want these diesel jennies to get the underground going, which looks like it's starting. Silverstone do that. They want to chuck in a solar farm. Silverstone do that. They want battery storage to make use of the solar energy for the night time. What do you know? Silverstone do that. Want to reduce the emissions on site. That's another good thing for permitting. Get some bloody battery vehicles, battery buggies floating around. Well, holy snap and duck shit. Silverstone do that. I feel now that any time you have a question about anything mining related, automated response will be Silverstone do that. Yep, vertically integrated, one-stop shop for mining. Silverstone love Guinea.
Yeah.
Kenny Keogh goes there once a year for a bit of a business refresh. I think that's where they have their team building sessions.
Yeah.
Mate, love it. Mate, pleasure doing business with you,
predictive. They say Siman do, not Siman don't.
Silverstone do, Siman do as well. Mate, so, yeah, permitting and jurisdiction is the big risk here. So because you got the PFS, which is this, and then the ESIA, the environmental document. They're the key documents they got to submit to get this.
I got one more. Silverstone say, yes, we ban can. Do it.
That's horrible.
Keep going, Matty.
Ban can do it. That's bad.
Go on, Matty.
I'm just going to keep it in there. Anyway. Permitting jurisdiction, we're talking Guinea, we're talking West Africa. Where you see on this map here, as you mentioned before, JD, they're right on the peripheral zone from this Niger National Park. So from there's a buffer zone, the peripheral zone, so they're sort of right on the edge there. So the PFS and the environmental document, they've got to submit that to the Ghanaian government to get the exploitation permit. So on track to submit that shortly. And look, you know, I suppose you look at the area, like it borders, when we're talking Guinea, we're talking borders Mali, Senegal, Sierra Leone, Cote d'Ivoire, Liberia. But there's a bit of gold mining in this, how do you pronounce it, Segeri Basin, JD? Sounds good.
I think that's
where the project's better, right, located. You've got big operations in there, that AngloGold Ashanti and Nordgold run. So, and on the interestingly on the political front, I think you've probably mentioned this, and I haven't listened previously, JD. But the last month, Guinea's then government was dissolved, and the military junta appointed a new prime minister. Military junta is a group that rules a country after taking power by force. So good old West, that's just West Africa. Love it. The new mines minister that was appointed, and I guess his initial speech was very centred around increasing the resilience of Guinea's mining sector via downstream value-add opportunities. Simandou going ahead is probably a sign of positivity for new mining in Guinea. So now,
Guinea's a massive exporter of bauxite already, and obviously trying to make a big presence in iron ore. And that, you know, de facto group that's in power, they first took over 3 years ago now, and they've sort of been just running the country with de facto power, and they're sort of rejigging it as they go.
Yeah, so I'll bring up the map. All the bauxite's in the west. This, we're talking in sort of the far northeast of Guinea, and then the iron ore's down in the south. So the country, Guinea, will have 15% free carried interest in this project. Then there's a 5% royalty and a 1% contribution to local development. So 6% of revenue does go out the door, which is pretty high. And I think then they have an option to purchase a further 5% to get up to 20% if they choose to. So there's a bit going on there.
Gotcha. Is that the NPV that came out today? That factor in though, that regime, the economic regime there?
You knew I wouldn't know that.
I would imagine it has to. The post-tax NPV numbers.
The 15% free carried interest, the royalty, et cetera. I think the, you know, the headline numbers there, that 25% IRR NPV, it's kind of calculated at the project level. So it kind of assumes the ownership of Project Co is not PDI separate from the government. It kind of just looks at all of it together. In reality, PDI would have to sole fund CapEx, but they only get, you know, what is it, 85% of the profit. So the you know, for equity holders of PDI, it's a bit worse than that. Of course, its PFS numbers kind of tend to change a little bit in the interim, and the fact that the stock's down like 12-odd%, it's probably just a little bit of disappointment with you know, the skinniness of that headline IRR, albeit at spot prices, things are better. But that'd probably be explained by the numbers.
I suppose then it's 85% of the profits, but 6% of the revenue goes out the door.
At the top line. That'd be baked into the PFS numbers. The royalty would be, but if you think of the, like they've calculated capital going out the door on a 100% basis and profit sort of coming in after, like those cash flows. Yeah. And so, they factor in the royalties. But if you think of the capital going out the door, that's 100% got to be stumped up by PDI, but they only get 85% of the profit.
So when you say 85% of the profit, is that profit calculated after the 6% of revenue and
6%
contribution
royalties
goes out?
Yeah. And a 15%, you know, equity stake for nothing.
Yeah, oh, they're laughing. This is what we need. Water's the other one that you look at with these studies to see if it's going to bugger them over. They do say, taking into account mine dewatering, they will remain net positive for water. So it sounds like they've got to pump the water out, recycle it, reuse it to remain net positive. It looks like the joint needs some get wet bladders to lock in that net water positivity. Don't you reckon, JD?
I sure do, mate. Get Wet's going global.
Oh, mate, aren't they? What? It'll be, mate, talk about an environmental tick of approval. If that water's being stored instead of pissing it down the Niger River, mate, I've even found out in a bit of weekend reading? These bladders apply to the coal seam gas plays over east too. Talk about environmentally saving the world. After they frack the shit out of the seams with a gut load of water, that water has to go somewhere. Why not chuck it in a get wet bladder and keep all those bloody over east farmers happy?
That's actually a very good use case, mate.
And another one, live from Indonesia, Matty Hall, he set up a get wet bladder to supply this massive fuck off ship with fresh water. And this fresh water is used for pressure testing seabed gas lines. Mate, wow. Get Wet Solutions is currently out there saving the world all around the world.
Unbelievable. So how does that work on the ship?
Well, he obviously stores it, then because a pumping system and piping system, which Get Wet installs as well as the bladder, pump it onto the ship and then they use it for all their bloody pipe testing.
Wow.
From what I understand, they need it to be reliable. They want it to run out the same pressure consistently. And the only one that can do that is Get Wet. So just give them a call.
Mate, the only company that does it in Australia. That's all you need to know. The things you find out on your weekend reading. Boys, let's touch on the financials, I guess, and more in the realm of, is predictive a takeover target? What are you, Maddie, predicting for this?
We're going to get into my weekend reading as well, because coincidentally, I was reading a Fundy's quarterly report for the first quarter, and predictive was mentioned in there. So I pulled it back up. It's from Paragon Funds Management, and it was a brief comment on a broader thematic of gold and copper. But to what they said about predictive, they just had in brackets, 5 million ounce plus takeover target amid a competitive M&A market. So PDI being one of their holdings, and it's the same sort of rationale that quite a few other people have spoken about who hold the stock. So you've got these rumors of it being a logical acquisition target for a number of West African, or just more broadly African, gold producers. The likes of Perseus, Endeavour, B2 have been sort of thrown around. Matty, you touched on Anglo, who operate in the country beforehand. Nordgold.
Nordgold, right in the district. You'd think they'd be having a bloody look.
Yeah, so not all of these companies have obvious mining synergies, but they've, you know, a lot of them have a track record of operating in the area and understanding the regulatory profile and the timing that these things sort of take. And of course, they often need a growth sort of story, which is, you know, we've spoken about it at length with Perseus, and they've obviously been attracted to OreCorp, which they've almost wrapped up now. So, you know, we've gone through the details of Bankan there. I think it's got some pretty attractive qualities, but when I read through it and I think about it, I continue to come to the same conclusion. I compare PDI with a number of the other producing miners in the country. And obviously they're a slightly different proposition. You've got one where you're kind of either hoping for a takeover and a premium, as well as potentially a re-rate if they get through construction, if that's what you're looking to hold it on for. But with PDI, you know, if they don't get that takeover, you've got this permitting and construction risk. That permitting, like you pointed to, Matty, can't be underweighted. It's pretty enormous. And then construction takes a while as well. So the numbers were pretty encouraging, but definitely not knockout. You know, you needed to flush through almost spot gold price to make it look quite encouraging. And then, of course, there's the ownership sort of regime that they have, plus the jurisdictional risk that you're operating in there as well.
Throwing risk of capital escalation too, because it was only PFS where you don't have, I mean, you know, DFSs tend to grow by 30% at least on top of that, and then reality Absolutely. Tends to be 30% higher again.
Yeah, definitely. And then you compare that with a Perseus or a WOF who are trading on pretty cheap multiples. And I'll chuck up a chart that I just did this morning with a bunch of West African as well as some Aussie, just for reference, mid-cap gold miners. And you can see the multiples. And I'll draw out a couple. You can see WOF there. They're trading at 4.7 times the next year's earnings. And you might think, you know, that's pretty rich. But that doesn't take into account Kiaka, which they're building. And, you know, granted, if everything goes well, that'll come online by the end of next year. And that multiple will drop again. You've also got Resolute. They've come out of a pretty rough period. They've recapitalized the business. Things are sort of on the up. They've had a bit of a rise in recent times on the back of the gold price and whatnot. They're trading at 2.7 times. And of course, Perseus, who, like I said, they're wrapping up OreCorp. They're trading at 3.5 times EV to EBITDA. So, you know, all in, I think these gold miners have a continual hunger for a growth story. And we've sort of fleshed out our rationale and our reasoning for why that might not always be the best case, and why we think they, in certain cases, should actually buy back their own stock as opposed to just do M&A. But I'm not sure if we're really going to change how a lot of these mid-cap miners think. So I do still think predictive is a target, especially if they, you know, get down to an attractive enough level. But at the price they're at currently, with, as you point out, the risk of CapEx escalation and the timing and the permitting, you know, I wouldn't be holding out for a takeover too soon.
I think the other thing too, JD, is it's Guinea. Like, I just think, like, if in certain parts of Africa, the best strategy, if you want to be taken over, is just sell to the highest Chinese bidder. Like, yeah. It's not about selling to the Perseus or WAF. It's like, literally, like, what happened to that that one where Dundee had a bid. I think it was Oskino. It was like a Canadian one, and then this Chinese group came in. I just think like these assets go to China, not Western buyers.
Yeah,
anymore.
I mean, we saw with Cardinal in a similar area as well. They had a bidding war between the Russian and Chinese group.
Tieto's about to get gobbled up.
The Russians won.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah. It's not a horrible strategy if you're a shareholder to just like, you know, take the bid from the Chinese as long as you cop a premium along the way, but the valuation isn't like you're going to get a crazy return by buying it corporately at this point in time. So, you know, maybe it'll take some time before that potential offer comes.
Jeez, yeah, I mean, that's unreal. Your bloody Westgold and Silver Lake trading at 3 and 3.4 times. Bloody low. At African levels.
Yeah. It is, mate.
Right. Alrighty, let's... JD, take us to bloody Putin territory, mate. How good's Russia?
On the theme of these sorts of countries. So Russian metals have been banned from the LME. Now, this is on the back of sanctions that have come through by the US and the UK. But if you look at some of the price action, it was pretty interesting. We saw LME priced aluminium up about 10%. That was their biggest jump for that metal since 1987. And nickel as well surged almost 9%. No, you wouldn't really be able to tell that from the ASX nickel stocks today. They're just so beaten and battered up. But on the aluminium or alumina front, you can see S32 is up to $3.44 now. So they're up 5% today. And you've also got alumina up to $1.58. So they're up over 5% today. And they're up about 60% since we spoke about the Alcoa takeover. So getting into what's actually happened here, like I said, the US and the UK have imposed these sanctions on Russian products. Now, this obviously applies to all this Russian metal that comes in, and the date is as of last Friday. So not a total surprise. It's been in the works for a little while. There is a catch though. Old metal is still permitted, and the sort of split between new and old metal is as of what was produced before or after April 13th, so a few days ago now. So apparently LME is still going to take this old metal, but they're going to sort of suss it out on a case-by-case basis. And this has led to some speculation that a good wave of supply could still hit the market. But overall, I think it's something pretty important to note because the London's Metal Exchange, they facilitate the pricing for these metals. And people have asked why this hadn't happened a couple of years ago now. And that's because buyers were still happy to take Russian product. But now that that's been banned, the LME is just reflecting that ban that's come by the country in which they operate. So the ramifications are pretty interesting to think through. The LME has often been the benchmark for metals pricing, and we've seen lots of people since we started the potty criticizing the LME for numerous different reasons. Nickel comes to mind in 2022 when there was that big debacle on the back of the short squeeze. Now, if you sort of compare the LME versus, say, Shanghai and their metals exchange, the LME gets far more of its product from Russia. So it's pretty meaningful. 91% of its aluminium comes from Russia, 62% of its copper, and 36% of its nickel. So if you compare the LME aluminium price, which I said before, up 10%, with the Shanghai price, that was only up less than 3%. So LME pricing isn't essentially the be-all and end-all, but heaps of contracts are still priced off it. And we spoke about with Luke and Joel from Wailu a while ago now about payabilities. Payabilities are obviously huge, but they're often still linked to the LME price ultimately. So taking a step back, if you look at what Russia produces in terms of metals, 6% of the world's nickel, 5% of the world's aluminium, and 4% of the world's copper is pretty bloody significant. But it makes me think of what happened in the oil market when Russian oil was sanctioned and the follow-on implications. It didn't leave the world supply of oil. It just got rerouted. So the global market just found another place for it to go, and the majority of the oil just went to India. So in this case, the ultimate outcome is that the metal is going to go to China. And, you know, that is the only place for the metal to go now. And in terms of, you know, Aussies and Western countries, how we think about this, I think like quite a bit of thought needs to go into it, because ultimately Russia and therefore China is just going to get more power in terms of pricing the refined metal, because even more of the metal now goes through the country. So I think there's some pretty serious ramifications from this that will sort of be clear in time.
What would they be, JD? What's an effect on the Western world? In summary,
well, we already talk about how much of the metal that we all need comes from Russia, and that you know we speak literally every day about how we need to do something about that, and that's only going to increase after this. You know, only more of the world's metal is now going through Russia, China rather, because the Russian metal has nowhere else to go. It used to go through the West, which gave the LME some, you know, significance in the pricing of these commodities, aluminium, nickel, zinc, copper. And now more of that power sort of just falls in the hands of China. I mean, the West is essentially buying the vast majority of it straight from the Chinese now. So, yeah, I mean, it's the same with the oil thing I just brought up before. You think you ban the oil supply from Russia, but it just finds another way into the world market and it just gets rerouted to India. And the oil price for the rest of the world went up because it's a less efficient trading route.
Because I think if you sanction Russia from taking their stuff, it's like you got to know the stuff is elsewhere. Uranium's the interesting one that the US Senate bill still hasn't come through to sanction that they're not going to take uranium off Russia. But most of the world's enriched uranium comes out of Russia. So where are they going to bloody get it from if they – yeah, I don't know. There's a lot to play out, JD, and you absolutely are going to be the man that delivers it to us. I bloody love your work. While you're on a friggin' roll, mate, Rio Tinto's Argyle blowout. So that's the diamond mine for those who don't know that Rio shut in late 2020. What's going on?
That's
here?
Right, mate. Yeah, the famous diamond mine. There's a book on this mine behind, I think, Trav there called Argyle. It's
authored by
interesting
Stuart
Kells. Yeah, it's a fascinating read about the history. This is the mine that produced almost all of the world's pink diamonds. So it's a pretty historical sort of mine. And like you say, Maddie, closed up in 2020. Their rehab liability has jumped from $580 million to over $850 million. So
just
pretty,
chuck it on
huge.
Top of ERA.
ERA, yeah.
Exactly. So another boot into them. Now, this one is not one that they can sort of kick down the road. They've already spent a lot of it. They've already spent $300-odd million closing and rehabilitating the land all around it. But the reasoning sort of stood out to me. It sounded awfully similar to a massive pre-production CapEx blowout. I'll give you some quotes. A result of general inflationary pressures, difficulties sourcing specialized labor and equipment, managing unforeseen issues relating to the nearby lake. So they expect that they can be finished with the closure and the rehabilitation by 2026. And, you know, it's a huge bill. I'm kind of glad it's with a company like Rio that has the pockets to be able to do it. And they were the ones that reaped the rewards from the mine for a long time. So it's obviously their responsibility to do. And obviously a great opportunity for them, given their recent track record to do a rehab properly.
Mate, that's a great point. And I think, like, you know, I hope we're in the era where the big miners just decide it's time to just, like, clean stuff up instead of kick the can down the road. Like, for example, if Nickel West goes on care and maintenance, which, like, economically it probably should just go on care and maintenance, like, let's see BHP clean up Kambalda. Like, don't kick the can down the road. Just clean it up.
Yeah.
Mate, I could not agree more.
It's
and I
like
think
a zombie apocalypse town when they're not mining nickel there, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just all left there.
Just clean it all up.
And the goodwill in the across the mining industry as well would be pretty huge if the miners can take responsibility for those ones. And, you know, in comparison to the huge dividends and profits from their iron ore business, you know, it's a substantial cost, but it's definitely achievable, so let's hope they can do the right thing.
No, if they clean it up, they can't go back in there, but...
Well, there's definitely no more diamonds there. Well,
no,
I'm
talking
sure
about nickel and Gambalda. It'll be back one day. Yeah. Right, speaking of Chinese ownership you mentioned before, Zhao Jin goes best and final at Tietto, and they've bloody upped the bid, Trav.
Mate, this is a JD story.
Oh, everything's a JD story these days. Mate, you're on fire 2 hours ahead
of us. All right, I'll fly through this one, lad. So we spoke about it a long time ago now. Late October is when Zhao Jin came in with their first bid. And it was in a period where the company was in a real lull. They'd been disappointing the market with announcement after announcements, just struggling to ramp up, struggling to get the production right.
It was a lot higher than they were, down to like 28, 29 cents. And then they had a point of recovery.
Yeah, they ticked up. Yeah. Exactly. So they ticked up a bit. And at the time, Zaojin were 7% shareholders. Now they're 7.7% shareholders. The initial bid was for 58 cents all in cash. And Tieto was, like you say, Matty, they ticked up. They were at about 40 cents roughly at the time. Tieto stock subsequently jumped to around about the bid price. And that's the level they sort of traded for the last 6 months. They've recently closed at 65 cents on the back of the sort of positive news around gold. At the time, Tieto's board recommended that shareholders reject the offer on the grounds that it was undervaluing the company and being highly conditional. To address this, Zaojin have come out today and they've upped the bid to 68 cents all in cash. So that's a 17% lift from their previous bid and a 67% premium to the undisturbed VWAP. And they've also removed the bid condition, simplifying the process. So they've received the Chinese approvals. And they said they're confident enough that they're going to receive the local approvals in the country there. So Zaojin continued to point to Tieto continuously disappointing the market. You know, they pointed to bad production ramp up, the uneven number of ounces year over year being produced. And Tieto, in defending themselves, said we've improved gold production, improved mining rates, costs are within guidance, and cash generation has been pretty good. And then they get this independent expert's report, which they were pretty proud of. They get a show to shareholders that the independent expert has valued them at 79 cents to 92 cents in between that range. And that's using 1650 US gold and 1730 US gold. So that was materially above the initial bid and where the stock was trading. And then you've also got Tieto's two largest shareholders who account for 18.7% of the stock, indicating that they're going to reject the offer. Add to that the board, who hold about 3% of the stock. If they can keep those on side with this updated bid, they just need to win over a couple more instos and they should be able to knock back the offer. But it remains to be seen what those two shareholders think is obviously pretty important.
Well, the interesting thing is it's best and final, right? So it's not like you're going to get an uplift from this party. So the decision for the board is do we take this on the table because we don't think there's anyone else that would buy it at that price, or do we continue to reject it because it's undervaluing what we think we've got? That'll be what unfolds here. And I mean, like, the stock's trading less than that 65 cents, so I think it's like 62 or something. So the
trading at 66 now, yeah.
Is it 66 now? So it's above
65 and a half.
Gotcha. So the market's kind of pricing in.
The bid was 68, so
yeah, okay,
in and around there. It's
okay. So if it's less than 68, then it's not exactly pricing in a higher bid at this point in time. TBA what the board come out and recommend to shareholders. I think a lot of that just hinges on those major Chinese shareholders, to be honest.
Absolutely.
Lovely. Trav, bit of a rapid fire to finish off, mate. Update on Sierra Rutile.
The fumble in the jungle, Matty. Admittedly, I think I was pretty harsh in the assessment of Sierra Rutile's board in early coverage, and I actually now think they've been pretty strong in their defence of the hostile bid from PRM. In the supplementary target statement uploaded today, they explicitly state they'll explore selling growth project Sembahon. The way to interpret the $400 million NPV that came out on Friday for that project, that's not what Sembahon is worth to Sierra Rutile. They'd have a much more onerous tax regime than they assume in that DFS, because they assume they get the same regime as Area 1, which would not apply to Sembahon. So, but that's what Sembahon could be worth to a hostile bit of PRM, who are pretty cozy with the government of Sierra Leone. So to me, it's pretty clear what the board's doing. I think they're edging for an appropriate uplift from the current offer on the table from PRM. The 9.5 cent offer doesn't cut the mustard, but would 15 cents, 16, 17, 18, like, that's probably where the board would be amenable to recommend a deal. If Sembahon is worth $400 million bucks to PRM, they're still getting a bargain, even at a decent uplift in price. The big unknown, though, is Sierra Rutile really in a position of strength to negotiate? Is there really any other buyer for this asset? If they ran a sale process, I'll be watching with popcorn.
Oh, and Gallen's at the market facility?
I think it's Gallen.
Gallen.
Gallen. Yeah.
Slipped in late Friday, mate. There's a $15 million ATM facility to Acuity Capital. Historically, you know, the announcement of these types of raisings have been marred with share price belting. And to top things
off,
we
love these ATMs.
Yeah, they went in, they went into halt this morning pending a permitting update, which I don't know, just doesn't, you know, I don't get a good feeling about that one.
Well, the ATM, you think of Hastings.
There's been a bunch.
Emerald goes finally go. Like, talk about the longest takeover in history.
Yep.
Emerald goes best and final for Bullseye.
Yep. Let's hope the world's longest takeover finally wraps up as a result and we see Emerald in the Laverton region.
Righto. We've got to go. We've got to call, mate. Thanks to the bloody partners at the top of the show, Get Wet Solutions and bloody Silverstone, because they can just do everything. Mate, we've also got Verified, DSI Underground, Anytime Exploration Services, WA Waterboards, Brooks Airways, and our great friends at K-Drill.
Hooteroo.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.